You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Steelworkers District 11 and Blake and Ulig, PA. United Steelworkers District 11, representing 33,000 members in the Midwest, protecting worker rights and organizing the unorganized. We support union-made products. Blake and Ulig, advocates for labor for over 40 years, proudly representing organized labor and its members throughout Missouri and Kansas. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, amid all the talk of walls and caravans, few are asking why families are fleeing Honduras. On tonight's show, we talk to labor historian Dana Frank on her new book, The Long Honduran Night. Then, Barry Eidlin's new book, Labor and the Class Idea in the U.S. and Canada, asks why U.S. unions are weaker than Canadian unions. Hear the answer on tonight's show. In the news, what's the Missouri minimum wage going to be in 2019? And which federal workers in Kansas City are laid off and which are working without pay? Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers. Now for the news. The news from our side, December 27th, 2018. Hundreds of thousands of federal workers are either working without pay or laid off because of Trump's partial government shutdown. Trump has shut down approximately one-third of the federal government because Congress refuses to agree to his demand for $5 billion for his Mexican wall at the U.S. southern border, a wall the people don't want. In Kansas City, they work for the IRS, Department of Agriculture, TSA, Air Traffic Control, and many other departments. Not affected are workers at the Department of Labor, Social Security, and the Veterans Administration. Ironically, the Border Patrol and ICE are either laid off or working without pay. According to statistics compiled by a local union official, there are 9 cabinet departments that are shut down because they aren't funded. Almost all employees are furloughed at the Department of Treasury, Commerce, except for the National Weather Service, thank heaven, who are working without pay. The National Park Service is not working. The State Department and the Housing and Urban Development are not working. All U.S. Department of Agriculture, except for food inspectors, thank you also, are furloughed, including the Forest Service, except for firefighters. Another good one. They're all working without pay. 42,000 members of the Coast Guard have no idea when they'll be paid, but they're working, even though and the same thing for the Border Patrol, with 17,000 working without pay and ICE. Transportation and Department of Justice workers are on the job, again, without pay. NASA is mothballed, and Trump's least favorite department, the Environmental Protection Agency, is too. For all of those affected by the shutdown, there's nothing partial about it. The bills keep coming in, and the lack of pay is full on. They'll receive their last paycheck tomorrow, Friday, so the crunch won't hit until 2 weeks from now, when 420,000 who are working without pay and 380,000 who are locked out without pay don't get a check. And even if Congress and the president manage to agree to reopen the government, those who were laid off will need a separate act of Congress to get their lost wages. David Cox, senior president of the American Federation of Government Employees, said, "This is the third shutdown in a year, and it's no way to run our country." He demanded that Trump stop holding America hostage.
The Washington Post is reporting on a story at Slate News, which is owned by the company that owns the Post. Journalists of the online publication, frustrated by stalled union negotiations, voted to authorize a strike against their owner, Graham Holdings Company. The vote was nearly unanimous, 52-1. What's striking about this potential strike news is that Slate has a union in the first place. The magazine was a digital pioneer founded by Microsoft Corporation in 1996 and later purchased by the Washington Post Company, which became Graham Holdings after it sold its eponymous newspaper to Amazon founder Jeffrey P. Bezos in 2013. Throughout most of its existence, Slate's newsroom was union-free. That all changed in January when it organized under the Writers Guild of America East, or the WGAE, and began bargaining for a contract. Slate is part of the wave of union organizing that has swept over the digital media industry over the past 3 years. One by one, journalists employed by the once scrappy startups and venture capital darlings of the internet have banded together to negotiate collectively.
Now that Missouri voters passed an increase in the state's minimum wage in November, the state's Department of Labor has announced that starting January 1st, the minimum wage will be set at $8.60. This applies to all private sector businesses unless their annual sales are less than $500,000 and they're in retail or service. Then, each year until 2023, the wage will go up by 85 cents until it reaches $12. Tipped employees must get compensation of at least $8.60 per hour. Employees must pay half of that in wages or $4.30 an hour and make up the difference if the tips plus wages don't add up to $8.60 an hour. This has been the news from our side, brought to you today by Judy Ansel, Jen Zeman, and I'm Jacob White.
Están atrás, van para atrás, piensan atrás, son el atrás, están detrás de su armadura militar. Nos ven reír, nos ven luchar, nos ven amar, nos ven jugar, nos ven detrás de su armadura militar. Nos tienen miedo porque no tenemos miedo. Nos tienen miedo porque no tenemos miedo. Nos tienen miedo porque no tenemos miedo. Nos tienen miedo.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. That was "They Fear Us Because We Don't Fear Them." I took my first trip to Honduras for the Cross-Border Network in August of 2009. It was less than 2 months after a general and Honduran oligarchs had staged a coup d'etat. They removed the elected president, Manuel Zelaya, in the middle of the night, shooting up his back door to gain entry and packing him off to Costa Rica in his pajamas. They made a brief stop to grab a plane at the local U.S. Air Force base. Honduras exploded in demonstrations, repression, the killing of innocents, and outrage from most of the rest of the Americas, except the U.S. When I got there in August, the resistance was already well organized and major leadership was coming from the labor movement. While there, I attended resistance meetings at the Bottlers Union. They represented workers at InBev, Budweiser, and many soft drink companies. I marched miles along with tens of thousands of Hondurans, many of whom were destitute, but still picked themselves up and walked across their beautiful and mountainous country to get to Tegucigalpa or to San Pedro Sula to protest. It was truly inspiring. I came home and got involved in Honduras solidarity work. Today, Honduras is a dictatorship propped up by the U.S. Democracy was never restored. Instead, despite all the protests, things are worse. It's become a narco state. Just last month, historian Dana Frank published a book covering this period called The Long Honduran Night. It's a must-read for anyone who cares to know why thousands are fleeing alone and in caravans and to understand the intractability of U.S. imperialism in Latin America. Dana Frank is a professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She's my kind of professor, an activist, and a labor historian. Her book, Buy American, The Untold Story of Economic Nationalism, is still one of my favorites. I've been touting it for years to all who think Buy America campaigns are pro-worker. She also wrote Bananeras, about the women's banana unions in Central America, particularly Honduras. Welcome to the show, Dana.
Thanks so much. It's such a great honor to be on your show.
Well, thank you. So let's start with the fact that Honduras was called the first banana republic. What does that mean? And are bananas and banana workers still important to the economy?
Well, I want to underscore that Hondurans today think that the term banana republic is an insulting term, so we want to be careful about how we talk about it. And as you noted, it has been called that for many years because it was under the control of United Fruit and the United States for decades and decades, and was one of the classic countries controlled by the United States in service to those banana countries and companies and other interests. And Honduras did have as many as 60 or 70,000 banana workers in the 60s and 70s. There are fewer now. But they also had the strongest labor movement in Central America for decades in those banana sector unions. Bananas still matter today, but they're not. But the banana companies, Chiquita and Dole, are still down there. But they don't have the political power or dominance that they used to. But they're one of the two backbones of the private sector labor movement, the workers, particularly at Chiquita, but also at Dole. And as you note, along with the bottling plant workers, they have been the backbone of the resistance to the coup.
Tell us about the coup. Why did it happen, and why did the Obama administration endorse it?
Well, the president that was deposed in the coup, Manuel Zelaya, came from one of the traditional two right-wing parties that had ruled Honduras for decades. But he was moving to the center, even center-left somewhat. He had doubled the minimum wage. He was starting to align himself with the democratically elected left and center-left governments that had come to power in South America and Central America in the previous 15 years. And those governments in general were a threat to U.S. domination of the region, and Zelaya was the weakest link in that chain. He didn't have himself a mass base. He didn't come out from an opposition party himself. And so the U.S. was sending a message to all those governments that we are going to overthrow you with military-backed coups, and we are going to support this. We don't have a smoking gun that the U.S. actually said green-lighted the coup ahead of time, but we do certainly know that what the U.S. did afterwards was to make it very clear that they wanted the coup to stabilize, and in fact, they did in fact do what they needed to do to line up the ducks to stabilize the coup regime ever since.
I want to talk about the resistance because, to me, you know, it was just overwhelming, the diversity of the resistance movement, and you cover that very well in this book, The Long Honduran Night. While the resistance has had its ups and downs, it still exists almost a decade later. And I know it through Karen Spring, the Honduras Solidarity Network coordinator based in Tegucigalpa, who has an encyclopedic knowledge about hundreds of struggles and who leads our delegations to Honduras. She spoke in Kansas City and St. Louis earlier this year. You cover many parts of the resistance in the book and its evolution over the years. Can you describe the issues it's concerned with and some of its struggles?
Yeah, I mean, initially when the coup happened, the resistance was this huge, our own fantasy coalition of the labor movement as a background, but women's movement, the Afro-Indigenous People's Movement, the Indigenous People's Organizations, the Campesino Small Farmers, the women's movement, the LGBT movement, and also the people from the traditional liberal party, and even the other ruling party, the National Party, that were committed to the rule of law and constitutional order. So the resistance covered a huge span of people in what we would imagine is our fantasy coalition. And it stayed then like that for about 2 years, when through complicated machinations, the more liberal party allied and certainly certain other elements of the resistance turned it into a political party. And there were some perfectly good arguments for that. That party, Libre, is extremely important ever since. But it also widened a divide between those that thought that, well, electoral action was the most important priority and those that wanted to keep building their social movements from the base and broadening that prong. Labor movement people span both camps there, and because there were people in the labor movement that had long been committed to trying to find an oppositional path to political action, but also were deeply embedded in supporting the Campesino movement and other movements. Today, the labor movement is still struggling. It sometimes can actually achieve important victories. I think people don't know that the Maquiladora export processing plants are somewhere, I think, around half unionized. They don't have a lot of gains because of those unions, but in some cases they do, and that's really happened in the last 2 years. And many of the banana workers have good, solid union contracts, and the bottling plant workers again, and there are also public sector union people that are very, very strong in the opposition, and the government has been going after those and, you know, just eliminating whole government departments that were unionized over the course of the last 5 or 6 years. And the social movements at the base of what people don't read about them up here, but the movements of indigenous people to protect their lands against hydroelectric dams and mining projects goes on and on as we speak. And people have probably heard of Berta Cáceres, who was central to one of those struggles and was assassinated in March of 2016. But the Campesino struggles to reclaim lands that elites had taken away from them in the Aguan Valley also continues.
Right. And, you know, you mentioned the Maquiladora. My organization did a investigation of the Haynes Corporation and interviewed a whole number of workers. And, you know, we can testify to the absolutely brutal working conditions, even though there was a complaint brought under the Central America Free Trade Agreement that was supposed to have improved conditions, especially since the rise of the current president, Juan Orlando Hernandez. There's been very little enforcement of the labor laws. We're talking to Dana Frank, who has just published a book called The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror in the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup, and it's published by Haymarket Books. Let me go to another topic, which you cover in a very interesting way in your book, and that's the media. You know, most people in the United States know very, very little about Honduras, and it's pretty evident from the reporting on the caravan that nobody is asking why these people are pouring out of Honduras. Trump may call them terrorists and strollers, but, you know, because there's so many babies on the caravan. But in fact, the media never asks the question. It never connects the dots between U.S. policy, Honduras as a failed state, and migration. What did you learn about the media as you researched this book and as you did your activism?
Well, you know, I sort of lived through these last 10 years of watching the media every day. And, you know, after some initial reporting about the coup, some of which is good and much of it just sort of ignored the human rights violations, then there was like complete silence for about 2 years. And then there was some actually in 2012 when it became clear that things were going south fast. There was some coverage about how terrible things had become down there. Peace Corps pulled out, the DEA killed four civilians claiming they were drug traffickers, and a lot of things. It became clear that the new director of police was a drug had been involved in death squad killings, and so things kind of blew up. But you know, the next moment was in 2014, and the sort of dry run for the caravan politics, which is the so-called crisis created by Breitbart News of 57,000 unaccompanied, undocumented miners arriving at the U.S. border. And there you could see this first round of coverage, which was about these kinds of issues about migration, which is things are really, really terrible down there. Everyone's powerless. My classic is sort of the powerless mother sobbing over her son's dead body in the morgue, and Washington Post had, for example, covered that kind of story. You would never have known at that exact moment that there was the biggest opposition political party in Honduran history, thriving right there in San Pedro Sula, that there was strong unions, a strong women's movement. So the history and politics and power and dedication of the opposition disappears from the narrative, and we've really seen this with the caravan. It's sort of as if Honduras is a natural disaster, and the U.S. support for the regime and the dictatorship's repression and the dictator's repression of the economy, the post-coup regime's destruction of the rule of law that opened the door for the gangs and extortionists, and that is deeply embedded with drug traffickers themselves at the very top of the government. That narrative disappears, and you just have a country that can't govern itself somehow, or that is naturally poor. You know, just in the last week or so, you're starting to see some new coverage, and that I would guess was in some ways coming from pushback from the State Department, which is as people are beginning to say, wait a minute, the U.S. has some complicity in this in the last month or two, that the U.S. is part of the cause of this. Now you get, yeah, the U.S. is the cause of this, but we should just give them even more money. And, of course, giving this government even more money is just like pouring millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, into these corrupt oligarchs and drug traffickers that are just going to steal the money all over again and continue to destroy the state and any viable livelihoods for Honduran people. So the media coverage is very slippery. I mean, you're starting to see peeps of the U.S. is maybe responsible for this, but then it gets spun over to, wow, the U.S. is doing really good things with its money now, and so that we should support these projects when the projects are not. There's no evidence that the U.S. So-called benevolent funding is actually helping people in, at a deep level.
Right. And, of course, they don't point out that the Trump administration, as I think you'd point out in your book, the Trump administration has cut all development aid and is just giving them bullets and tear gas.
So, actually, it's actually more complicated than that. Trump said we should cut everything, but his actual State Department hasn't done that.
Uh-huh.
So there's like schizophrenia up there, like we know on so many issues today. So Trump tweeted cut all the money, but they did not, in fact, ever move to cut all the money.
Uh-huh.
The actual State Department itself and its allies in Congress and in the media are pushing for even more money, which is meaning giving even more money to those folks. And the position of the opposition and of the solidarity move in the U.S. is to cut the security aid to the police and Honduran military that are killing people with impunity, and also stop legitimating this government with the security aid. And let's also look at the economic development aid and who it's really going to.
Right. And, of course, it seems that the U.S. media never really wants to talk about U.S. imperialism.
You certainly don't see that word. Now, who's the U.S. media? I mean, the opposition media has been, you know, terrific. Amy Goodman's terrific. There are just so many, Rising Up with Sonali, so many great programs that are really wonderful about talking about U.S. imperialism. But the mainstream media, there's a great line from a friend of mine's book in which she says the U.S. has historically trained people to think that the only solution to problems caused by U.S. intervention is more U.S. intervention.
Yeah, right.
And the Hondurans will say, just please leave us alone. Please, you know, the Hondurans in the opposition, let us have that free space for our own democratic processes. Let us have sovereignty. And, you know, they're calling for a new election. It's very clear that current President Juan Orlando Hernandez stole the election a year ago. And the Honduran opposition and many interesting groups of the center as well are calling for a new election, and that's what we need to be listening to, what the Honduran people are saying. Not give more money to this government,
right,
and the crooks, but let them have a new election so they could have their own government, not one imposed by the United States.
I thought it was pretty funny that when the most recent caravan started up, Trump threatened to cut the aid to Honduras, and a lot of people I know in Honduras kept saying, bring it on, cut the aid.
Bring it on, you know.
Exactly.
But, you know, for different reasons. He's doing it for a punishment of the caravan. Of course, we do not want to align ourselves with Trump in any way. But, you know, you can see the center and certain some even some liberals in Congress about the answer to the caravan is to pour even more money in there. And I want to underscore, that's not the answer. We don't have transparency about where that money goes. No one's really researched it.
Right.
And it just becomes giving these folks even more money. And certainly, you know, we're going to reintroduce the Berta Cáceres Human Rights in Honduras Act at the beginning of the year,
mm-hmm,
which calls for a suspension of U.S. security funding Honduras. We had 71 members of the House on it. In the last 2 years, we need to get all those people back on.
I'd like to add that our local Congressman Emmanuel Cleaver has signed on to the Berta Cáceres law, which would cut all funding, and has been very cooperative. And now that we have a new congressperson from the Kansas 3rd District, we're hoping that she also will become supportive of human rights in Honduras.
Well, and we have so many Congress members on there because of grassroots support, like folks that are listening here, you know. They don't just randomly support these things. They do it because if they're good, they listen to what their constituents want. And it's a really important vehicle that us to have our own democratic processes up here in the United States and take responsibility for our own tax dollars that are going into the Honduran police and military.
Absolutely. I want to go back and talk a little bit more about the current president, Juan Orlando Hernandez. Hondurans call him Juan Robando, which seems apt, or they just refer to him by his initials, which are J-O-H, which in Spanish is pronounced ho, and fuera ho, get out ho, is all over the walls in Honduras. They can't seem to white it out fast enough because it reappears. Can you talk about not so much the stolen election last year, which I think was covered in the media, but talk about his policies, especially toward workers.
Yeah, I mean, he himself is, as you know, is a criminal who supported the coup and overthrew the Supreme Court in 2012. He's a criminal backwards and forth. And he certainly, in terms of labor issues, it's important that the labor movement is being repressed because of this larger context of repression, not just about labor rights. But there, you know, Honduran labor law isn't so bad, but the issue is it's just not getting enforced. So Right. Even in really famous cases like the melon workers or banana workers or maquiladora workers that get international attention, labor law is not being enforced. So this is again part of this larger pattern of the rule of law. It's also in terms of the public sector workers. They're, like I said before, they're just getting laid off. I mean, forget bargaining. They're just having their whole jobs eliminated. So it's definitely a war on the workers, but that war on the workers is possible because of this larger context of repression. For example, the military and the police used live bullets against peaceful protesters and bystanders a year ago when people were protesting the stolen elections peacefully. And that's the first time they've used live bullets, even since the coup. Mm-hmm. Live bullets were used again against Chiquita workers on strike in the spring, and that's the first time, I don't even know when, probably back to the 30s, that live bullets were used against strikers or their supporters in Honduras. So you can see this general escalation of repression of civil liberties is part of the repression of the labor movement. And of course, the government knows that the labor movement is the backbone of the opposition.
I think we have time for one last question, Dana. I started this interview saying that you are both a scholar and an activist. It's clear throughout the book that you are no impartial observer, and you took risks to witness confrontations between groups defending their rights and their land and the government forces. So, two questions. What do you say to the academics who think you should be detached and objective? And two, are you going to continue your activism? And if so, how?
Well, these are great questions. You know, first of all, I want to say I took risks, but I want to underscore that my risks are a fingernail compared to what the Hondurans, the risk that they take all day, every day, and they're all at risk of being killed at any moment. And I get to get on that plane to come back to the United States,
right.
And I also have white privilege when I go down there as a middle-class white U.S. citizen. So my risks are nothing compared to those, and the question is, of course, how do I use my privileges to fight for them? You know, as far as being an academic, you know, there's all kinds of academics that are involved in policy issues. We don't even think about it that way when we look at the business school, for example. When we look at all kinds of policy people and political scientists that are all over Congress, all over their Senate, you know, they're talking to people all the time, and we don't think of that as being an activist. And then when somebody who's coming from the left does that, like, oh, suddenly you're an advocate or you're an activist. And so, first of all, I want to underscore that because it's not something that I am suddenly kind of flaming activist. I'm an academic who is doing policy work based on my expertise. And somebody high ranking in Senate Foreign Relations Committee asked me a couple months ago, "Are you doing this as an activist or an academic?" And I said, "If I were an academic and I knew what I knew and I didn't do anything about it, there'd be something wrong with me morally."
Good for you.
Which is not to judge people who don't. People have other priorities. But it's like, if you know this and you don't try to go talk to the powers that be about it, you know, there's many paths to looking about power about it, but it was just the one that I chose because I was going nuts, waiting for who was going to get killed next, frankly. So for me, it was a very personal thing that has driven this. Mm-hmm. And it's been a whole analysis of power, working with Hondurans, working with Hondurans in the United States, working with other people in the North in the transnational understanding of power and how it works. And yes, using skills I have as an academic about being able to track things and analyze things and aggregate information and be able to present things in bullet points. You can see the skills there. Whether I'm continuing right now, I'm going on book tour for the next few months. I am continuing to talk to Congress regularly, along with many, many other people. It's not just me.
Thank you very much for being on the Heartland Labor Forum, Dana Frank. The book, again, is The Long Honduran Night. It's published by Haymarket. Thanks, Dana.
Thanks so much.
Black girl, black girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? In the pond, in the pond, where the sun never shine. I wish you were all night too. Black girl, where will you go? I'm gone where the cold wind blows.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Heartland Labor Forum. That was In the Pines by Leadbelly. And for the second half of our show tonight, we have Professor Barry Eidlin with us. Barry, are you there?
Yes, I am. And just to give you fair warning, so is my 6-month-old daughter, so she might be adding some extra commentary.
Okay. Well, we like diverse voices here, and they don't always have to be clear, so that's another good part of community radio.
Good.
Well, thanks for coming back on the show. We've had you on a couple times, and you're a friend of Michael Savoir, who's a dear participant in the show, an important contributor. So thanks again for...
Indeed, we go way back.
Awesome. And we're here to talk about your new book, which is Labor and the Class Idea in the United States and Canada. And I'm sure this is kind of a tricky question, but could you maybe just tell us a little bit about what... why this specific topic is interesting to you, and maybe how your labor background increased your interest in this topic?
Yeah, I think it might be more useful to talk about why it's important to a broader audience, right? Because sure. I think it's really about, the book is about why unions are stronger in Canada than they are in the U.S., but haven't always been that way. Historically speaking, for much of the 20th century, unions in both the U.S. and Canada followed similar paths, but then diverged. And now unionization rates in Canada are nearly 3 times higher than they are in the U.S. And this is important. I mean, this is a labor audience. The people listening to this show is a labor audience. But it matters even if you don't think you care about unions, because if you care about growing inequality, if you care about the erosion of a democracy, then you need to care about union decline. And so there's a lot of discussion about why unions have declined so much in the U.S., going from nearly a third of the workforce in the 1950s and 60s to about 1 in 10 today, which is probably not news to a lot of your listeners. But explaining why that precipitous decline has happened is a really important concern for a lot of people. And because that decline has really been a huge contributing factor to the ability of working people to have a voice in society and to make ends meet. You know, so the stagnation of wages over the past 40 years and growing inequality, the ability of the top 1% to basically extract more and more of the profits that our society makes is all a huge part of that is because union power has declined so much. And so it's really an important question for a huge majority of Americans to figure out. And for me, it has a personal element because, as you hinted at, you know, before becoming a sociologist, I was a union organizer, working particularly in the Teamster Reform Movement, which is how I know Michael Savoir. And so I had personal experience with the challenges that workers trying to sort of fight for a better life have, sort of on a more gut level. And I brought that sort of gut level concern with these problems to my research. And so that's sort of the personal angle.
You touched on it a little bit in your answer, but I think a big part of this is how much harder it is to organize as labor. You said, you know, the working class has an objective interest in not being exploited. And that seems pretty obvious. Like, you don't want to be, you know, ripped off and taken advantage of, but it's so much harder to organize. And I know it's kind of a basic idea, but you don't really shy away from how much easier it is for the 1% to organize. And can you maybe just talk about, you know, how you know, the cards are so stacked against labor?
Yeah, so it happens on a variety of levels. I mean, there's basically the fundamental inequality that exists between labor and capital is the simple fact that workers need to stay employed more than employers need to keep any individual worker employed, in the sense that workers' main source of income, their livelihood, depends on staying employed in our current society. So if you don't have a source of employment, that means you're deprived of income. And so whereas any individual employee, like obviously if there's a really tight labor market, you know, that can be a hassle for an employer, but it's not a life-threatening one. They're not at risk of starving. And so that just creates a fundamental imbalance on an individual level. So workers, and that also creates a power imbalance. So right off the bat, there's a power imbalance, and workers basically both have more of a need to act collectively because of that, because otherwise they have their virtual, as an individual, workers have almost no power in society, particularly when they're up against, a large employer. And then they also have the additional problem that it's harder for them to organize, just structurally speaking, compared to capitalists, because many capitalist employers, you know, basically they can satisfy a lot of their needs just through their own personal wealth, you know, or their own sort of personal connections or what have you. As individuals, they can solve a lot of their day-to-day problems. And the ones that need collective resolution are usually fairly, I mean, it's not like they never fight with each other, it's quite the contrary, but there's usually just sort of a coordination of sort of material interests of dollars and cents that they can sort of rationally calculate and sort of figure out with themselves. When it comes to workers trying to sort of like solve their collective problems that they face, there's a much wider array of problems that they need to solve collectively. You know, so some workers, you know, might have to take care of, they might have more kids at home, or they might have an ailing relative, or they might have a neighborhood that's less safe, or they might, you know, be at risk of getting evicted, or they might have schools that, you know, need, you know, there's a whole wide array of things that they have to resolve collectively. And so, not only do they have to resolve these things collectively, but they also, in order to take action collectively, have to figure out a way of getting a collective together and of sort of reconciling all these mutual interests. Some of, you know, there has to be some prioritization, there has to be some sort of unifying frame, and that just structurally creates a lot more barriers to taking action as a collective for workers compared to employers. Then that's not even before, that's before we even get to any specific challenges that workers face in the U.S. context compared to Canada. I can talk about that if you want, or if you want to add an additional question at this point.
Yeah, we're talking to Professor Barry Eidland from McGill University. His new book is Labor and the Class Idea in the United States and Canada. I thought I would bring it a little bit closer to home here in Missouri, because I think there's been some interesting things that have happened here in Missouri that play into your thesis a bit, especially the right to work repeal.
The right to work law,
And I would also add the raising the minimum wage, which passed as a referendum. And then on top of that, I think we also see some of the issues that have to do with some of these social divisions that come into play that make it hard. Even, you know, as like the Democratic Party or something, like the, you know, as Senator McCaskill, who lost her seat, even though The minimum wage was raised and marijuana reform was passed. And so there was a lot of questions about that. But she also has been sort of critical about Ocasio-Cortez. And so that, I think that's also sort of like this electoral issue. And then also like what happens outside of the arena of elections and what happens in the run up to elections. So you've been looking at this for a while. Can you sort of like take us through this as an expert? What do you think's been going on in Missouri?
Well, I'm not as familiar as maybe some of your listeners are with specifics in Missouri, but I would say that what the results in Missouri show, and this is something that I've written about elsewhere, is that labor. I mean, so if labor sort of confines its efforts to the sort of usual channels, meaning trying to influence, influence sort of sitting politicians and trying to, take their case to the court, they generally lose. It's only when they are able to change the venue in which they're fighting, so basically taking the fight into the streets and into the workplaces, that unions stand a fighting chance. And I think that the way that we've seen this unfold in Missouri is indicative of what I'm talking about there, because the campaign to repeal right to work, while it was electoral in one sense, and that it was a ballot initiative, but there was a mass movement that labor basically built to get people on board, because obviously they couldn't just get their own members on board. They had to, the number of union members in Missouri is not nearly enough to win a ballot initiative. They had to really convince a broad array of people. So they had to basically show why repealing right to work was in the interest of the broad majority of workers. So it wasn't just it made it hard, because the problem that labor faces in the U.S. generally is that they often get painted as this narrow special interest that's only fighting for their own members, right? That's people like Scott Walker, really made a, and even, Eric Greitens in Missouri before he got removed, really made hay out of this idea of, labor is a special interest. They don't need any special favors. And so this law sort of evens the playing field. Whereas with the repeal, they really showed that, labor is fighting for all workers. And when they get to frame their issues in that way, they stand a much greater chance of actually winning and getting things done that will actually improve lives for all workers.
And to sort of back out a little to scope and go back to your book a little bit, you talk about how the separation or the division sort of in the trajectories between the Canadian and U.S. labor movements is sort of spurred in the Great Depression and World War II. And that's sort of seen as a novel idea and sort of just that the ideology emerged from there and not so much from further in the past. So can you talk about some of the big moments in the Great Depression and World War II that led to this split in the trajectory between the two labor movements?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, it's important to understand that the actual division happens in the mid-1960s, right? So it's really in the 1960s that you start getting this divergence between the U.S. and Canada. And traditionally, when people think about the difference between the U.S. and Canada and why unions are stronger in Canada, there's generally two sets of arguments. It's either that it's labor laws that are better in Canada, or it's that there's some sort of deeply embedded, more collectively oriented political culture in Canada that just sort of, as opposed to the sort of like pull yourself up by your bootstraps American individualism, that's just sort of more innately hostile to unions. And both of these explanations sort of fall short, because the labor law explanation, a lot of the labor laws only started getting better in Canada after the divergence was underway. And then as for the political culture argument, these political cultures, to the extent that they differed, were different for a long time, well before the divergence. So you can't explain that. And so the paradoxical thing that I find is that it's actually the moment where people think of as sort of the most pro-labor moment in American labor history, namely the New Deal, that actually laid the foundations for labor's long-term weakness. So it's actually these, and the paradox here is that the sort of more pro-labor response of the U.S. government to the labor upsurge of the 1930s. So here we're talking about Franklin Roosevelt and the Wagner Act and that kind of thing. Ultimately laid the ground for long-term weakness in the U.S., while a more hostile state response in Canada. So the Canadian Prime Minister at the same time as Roosevelt was this guy, R.B. Bennett, who responded to the worker upsurge of the 1930s by vowing to crush it under the iron heel of ruthlessness. And that more hostile state response in Canada ultimately laid the foundation for a stronger labor regime that protected union rights more in Canada. And the reason for this is that at a fundamental level, several things. First of all, the idea in the U.S. was that labor sort of, the New Deal basically incorporated labor into that New Deal coalition as a special interest. So this idea of labor being this sort of narrow special interest actually emerges in this period. And that, as opposed to in Canada, where because they have to fight harder against the government, when they do win labor rights a decade after their American counterparts, they get incorporated into the political system not as a special interest, but as a class representative, meaning that they are seen as sort of representing the interests of a sort of whole class, of the working class. And so, the labor regime in Canada is not necessarily oriented like it is in the U.S. around sort of defending and articulating a set of collective bargaining rights, which is what the Wagner Act does, which then sets the stage for employers and individuals sort of like claiming that they have countervailing rights, so you need to balance collective bargaining against employer property rights, against individuals' free speech rights. Within Canada, because that sort of the labor rights are only extracted from a hostile state under extreme duress, when they finally get them, even people who are hostile to unions, who really don't want anything to do with them, understand that we need a labor regime that's going to keep a lid on industrial conflict. We don't necessarily like it, but we need to deal with them. And so it creates a labor regime that's much more stable, because even those who are hostile towards labor understand the virtue of at least having a system in place that can keep a lid on industrial conflict. Whereas in the U.S., this labor getting incorporated into the New Deal coalition as a special interest politicizes labor conflict along party lines. So whenever labor gets something, labor rights get portrayed not as sort of a practical means of containing industrial conflict, but as a payoff to a Democratic Party special interest. And meanwhile, sort of every effort to increase labor rights is sort of met with this idea of counterbalancing it against sort of competing employer property rights and individual free speech rights. And that's what lays the groundwork for things like right to work. So right to work is the idea being that, well, the Wagner Act has the right to join a union, but we also need to protect the right not to join a union. So that's right to work. And then something like employer free speech rights, so which means that, oh, employers in a union campaign need to be able to present their side of the story to workers, which creates the foundation for these hostile employer anti-union campaigns that basically makes the workplace into a place where employers can terrorize their employees into not joining a union. So those different initial conditions of how labor rights emerged in the two countries set the stage for a labor regime that was more protected in Canada and was more subject to erosion over time in the U.S.
We're talking to Barry Eidlin. The book is Labor and the Class Idea in the United States and Canada. I think only have time for about one more question, but I wanted to ask, just in light of all of this information about how much more hostile it was, do you think that that there's some reason for optimism in the current situation with two more years at least of President Trump in terms of reorienting where union organizing energy goes?
Yeah, I think that there's definitely been some very promising signs, most importantly being the wave of teacher strikes in these red states that we've seen, right? Because those have taken place in places where the laws are stacked against them. These are all right-to-work states, and some of them collective bargaining is even illegal for public sector employees. And they've won by taking their message to the streets and into the workplaces, which is really where labor needs to focus its energy. And I think that that's sort of the combination of the Trump presidency sort of like putting on hold any idea that there's going to be any kind of legislative relief. So that avenue is a non-starter. And so workers, in order to have any kind of a chance, need to actually organize in the workplace and actually take their message out into the public through these kinds of strike waves that we've been seeing. And so I think that after decades of sort of this rhetoric that strikes don't work and that that's a losing proposition, we're actually seeing that that's actually the only way forward. It's not guaranteed way forward, but it is the only way that labor has a fighting chance.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us, Barry, and best wishes on happy holidays to you and your colleague. We'll have to hear more from her later.
Thank you so much. Great to be on.
All right. Thank you. And this has been Jacob White. You're listening to Heartland Labor Forum.
That should tell you that we're about to talk to Mark Grunberg with Washington Window on Workers. This is Judy Ansel. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you, Judy.
So you just wrote an article called Goodbye and Good Riddance to the 115th Congress, and you start with a quote from, of all people, Oliver Cromwell in 1653, in which you say, "You have sat here too long for any good that you have been doing. Depart, I say, and let us have done with you. In the name of God, go." So these are your sentiments, Mark, about the 115th Congress?
Yes. That was pretty, Oliver Cromwell pretty much put it in a nutshell. The only reason that I had to pick the five worst moments, worst times in Congress, was because we have only 15 minutes to talk.
It's a longer list, yes. Okay, so what I want you to do is start with the least bad and go to the most bad of your okay. pick of five. So what's the least bad?
The least bad is the least bad only because it hasn't played itself fully out yet, and that's the two Supreme Court justices, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. And they've just started their terms. They'll probably move up the list in the future, but right now they're just on the court for, you know, a year or so. But they're already making a mark as far as being on the right. Ideologues and judicial robes.
Okay, number two.
Yeah. The fourth worst is deregulation in general. This Congress, at the beginning, passed something like 12 to 14 uses of what's called the Congressional Review Act, which had been used only once before in 20 years, and that was to get rid of the ergonomics rule, to basically trash all sorts of pro-worker, pro-consumer regulations. You name it, and they used it to trash some late Obama-era rules. And the bad part of the CRA is, once you use the CRA, not only does that trash the rule then that protects consumers, but it prevents the agency involved from ever enacting that type of a rule again.
Oh, wow. That's pretty bad. What could be worse than that? Number three?
What could be worse? Number three is a combination of voting rights and workers' rights. In this case, inaction and no action. The Voting Rights Act was emasculated by the Supreme Court, and that's even before Kavanaugh and Gorsuch got on. There's been nothing done about it. Workers' rights have been gone by the board in both the agencies and on Capitol Hill again. It's just been a rollover.
Okay. Well.
And speaking of rollovers, that's number two.
Oh yeah.
My number two is basically the Republican majority rolled over for Trump.
Mm.
There has been little to no resistance among the Republicans, and they've been running the show.
Well, you're forgetting Bob Corker.
That's why the Democrats in the House are so important.
What about Bob Corker? Didn't he refuse to roll over?
He refused to roll over, at least rhetorically, and the same thing goes for Jeff Flake. But when it came to their votes, it was another matter. That's the problem.
Uh-huh. Okay, so drum roll, what is the worst of the worst that they did?
What else? As if we didn't know, the tax cut for the rich and corporations. And we're going to be paying for this through our lives and our kids' lives and our grandkids' lives, because it's not only does it make income inequality even worse than it already is, and we're getting worse by the year, but it's going to add to the create $1 trillion deficits as far as the eye can see.
Okay, so these are pretty bad. We did dodge the bullet on a couple of things, though. What were those?
We dodged the bullet on the actual repeal of the Affordable Care Act.
Oh, right. I remember that.
Trump from trying to hollow it out.
Uh-huh. Okay. Although he did get rid of the individual mandate, which is going to, in the long run, really screw things up.
Right.
Yeah. And what was the other thing? Did we dodge any other bullets?
The only other thing actually came right at the end. I didn't mention this in the editorial, and that's at least they made a start on criminal justice reform,
uh-huh.
Especially trying to equalize the sentences and let people out who shouldn't have been in jail in the first place.
So they did one thing good, huh?
Yeah.
Okay,
that would
good.
Be it, right at
All
the
right.
end.
All right, so bye-bye.
We haven't even talked about the shutdown.
Oh, right. Oh, but you know, I don't blame them as much as I blame Trump for that. But anyway.
Oh, yeah.
So bye-bye, 115th Congress, and I take it you're more optimistic about the 116th?
I'm more optimistic, but only because I have a feeling that what's going to happen is good ideas in the House will get passed by the House. But then the Senate will kill them. Bad ideas in the Senate will get passed by the Senate, and the House will kill them. And so the result will be basically not that much action at all, which will be an improvement over this Congress.
Right, and then Trump will have somebody to blame.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. I look forward to 2019 just as much as you. Thank you, Mark. Happy New Year.
Yes, okay. Happy New Year. Oh, and in order to prevent all this stuff, we got to get out in March again. So.
Okay, well, I'll see you on the March line, I guess.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. We've been talking to Mark Gruenberg with Washington Window on Workers, and of course, he is in Washington, D.C. And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar, which is full of stuff starting next week. Not much this week. There is a cross-border network meeting on Sunday at 1 p.m., and you can call us at 816-835-4745 for the address. If you listen to the Honduras interview we just did and you want to get involved, you're invited. On Monday, January 7th, Wyandotte County Legislative Delegation Forum, talking about the upcoming legislative session. It will be from 6:30 to 8:30 at the South Branch Library, 3104 Strong Avenue, KCK. Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee meeting, Tuesday, January 8th, 6:30 p.m. at All Souls UU Church. And we are out of time. You can find our calendar on our website at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also find our archived shows and our upcoming schedule. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is called Will the New NAFTA Stop Oreo Mexico from Sickening Its Workers? And thanks to our engineer, Jen Zaman.
Now after 15 years, I'm on
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.